The dream 50 years ago was of a golden age that would dawn once Alaska became a state and could control its own resources. What did we end up with? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska on Primary Elections Day, 50 years to the day after Alaskans voted to take their place among the 48 states. I'm Steve Heimel. What is that place? What was it? What can it be in the future? The phone lines are open at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422 for a rip-roaring discussion of whether Alaska leads in anything on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The Alberta tar sands are now producing more oil than Alaska. Alaska is producing about 700,000-odd, and they're producing 1.6. So we don't even lead in that anymore. Steve Haycox, author of, several things, Alaska, an American Colony, is with us today. Steve, thanks for coming and joining us today.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to be here.
You are a professor of history at the University of Alaska, Anchorage.
I am.
And your position in this book is, I would say, fairly well known, that Alaskans don't like to think of themselves as being dependent on the federal government, but basically they are.
Well, not just the federal government, although that's a big piece of it, and I think that we may have a tendency to underestimate, fail to appreciate just the extent of that. And a study done several years ago now at ISER at UAA, Scott Goldsmith and Jamie Kenworthy and others found one-third of Alaska's economic base to be resting on federal spending. But there's also a really heavy dependence on outside absentee corporate investment, which is what we called it before statehood. Now we call it the oil industry. Another one-third of Alaska's economic base is oil. It's not just the production of oil, but it's the oil patch servicing. And, of course, particularly the taxation on oil, which still today funds 80 to 85% of the state fisc, of state funding.
Yeah. And then there's the military.
Well, which would be a piece of the federal, I guess. It would be a part of the federal economic base. The piece of the federal that I think we may miss is all of the spending for the 60% of Alaska's land that is still in federal title. The whole conservation mechanism out there has gotten really very, very large. And so when you add that in, and then the more permanent things that we have, the highway spending, 90 cents of every new highway construction dollar of a state highway, which would include things like C Street and Elmore, are federal funds, of course.
Well, Steve, if we go back 50 years, we had seen in the period of a couple of short months that the U.S. House had passed statehood, the Senate had passed it, and the president had signed the bill, and yet it still had to go back to the people in the next election, which was the primary election of August 26th.
It went back to the people because Congress mandated it, that it had to go back to the people. There'd been a referendum in 1946. The territorial legislature after the war had thought, well, now is the time to start thinking about statehood. The delegate at the time, Bob Bartlett, thought that would be appropriate. And so there was a statewide plebiscite, territory-wide plebiscite, which came out about 9,400 for and 6,800 against, which was pretty conclusive, hardly a perfect majority, but pretty conclusive. The significance of that was that all the time during the statehood campaign then, from 1946 to 1958, if somebody in the Congress or anywhere else said, well, how do you know Alaskans really want statehood? Well, you could point to that referendum and say, well, they voted overwhelmingly for it in 1946. But by 1958, the Congress said, well, that's a little shop-worn. And so just in order to make sure that this is consistent with the will of the people of Alaska, they included that provision, which they had in other modern statehood bills as well, that the people had to vote to approve what Congress had done.
Was it much of an issue?
I don't think it was any issue at all. It passed overwhelmingly. The only thing that outpolled it on the ballot was the measure to ban to ban fish traps, and that one passed by 80-20.
Wow. it's great to have a history professor on the show, because it's always I always learn all this stuff about our state. For instance, the 1946, you know, I have come to realize that that was an interesting year in terms of the military presence in Alaska, because that year they were actually drawing down the forces.
It was scary. 1946 was very scary. I had the opportunity to interview 40 people some years ago who had lived in Alaska in 1940 and were still living in Alaska in 1994 when I interviewed them. And virtually every one of them remembered 1946 as a very scary time, because there had been all of this huge expenditure during World War II, of course, and all of these people, 150,000 people in the territory because of the war, a territory that it had only 30,000 non-natives and 30,000 natives in 1940. And everybody held their breath, because it looked like that was all going to come to an end. And where would Alaska be? It had had this huge blowtorch, economic blowtorch, turned on during the war. And I can remember one woman told me that she had gone to work in 1942, and she was married, and there was a job for her. Married women weren't that present in the workforce in those days. And she made $1.50 an hour in 1942, and she couldn't believe it. She was 2 years out of high school, and she was used to making 65 cents an hour, and she was making $1.50. It was just extraordinary. So in 1946, people were really, really worried what was going to happen.
Well, the numbers are pretty surprising, and this is right from your book, Alaska, an American Colony. And you say about 300,000 military personnel served in Alaska during the war, about 150,000 at the period of greatest strength. The resident population then was about 81,000. The United States spent about $3 billion in the territory over the entire course of the war and so forth. The civilian population grew dramatically from about 60,000. So we have 81,000 at the time of the war, 60,000 in 1940, to more than 100,000 by the end of the war. Clearly, a lot of these people stayed.
A lot of these people did stay, and they were innovative. They were flexible, and they had to be. And we still see that a lot in lots of Alaska, though less perhaps in the urban center. You do what you have to do. For example, Charles Brewster of Brewster Clothing Store. Well, Charles Brewster started a laundromat in Mountain View at the corner of Bregaw and Commercial or Mountain View Drive. And where he got the material to put up his laundromat was down where the Lions Park is today, down at the east end of Mountain View on Mountain View Drive. Was a big surplus pile. What the military was doing was taking all the stuff that it couldn't sell and it didn't want to ship back to the States, and it piled it up in this lot. And so guys would go down there. Another guy who did that was Zappa, who lived in Mountain View and owned a number of properties. They went down to this pile.
John Zappa.
John Zappa, that's right. And they salvaged lumber and other material out of that junk pile and took it down and built a substantial part of early Mountain View.
But so see, that's folk history. That doesn't show up in the history books. You know?
Well,
I appreciate you bringing these things
history
up.
Books aren't long enough, I guess.
There you go. Well, I'd like to turn to the theory, because, you know, Wally Hickel has been governor of Alaska twice and has insisted on this statehood compact theory that during the statehood struggle, the terms that Alaska got from the federal government were somewhat onerous in terms of the federal government was going to hang on to a lot of the land, and that therefore the state had, they needed to make allowances with the state in terms of like a contractual agreement with the federal government, the rest of the states. Now, generally speaking, the courts have not been friendly towards the statehood compact theory.
They haven't. And with all due respect to Governor Hickel, for whom I have the greatest respect and who I hope will be remembered for his commitment to Alaska, which is, I think, without peer, But with all due respect, when he became governor the second time, he filed a suit. Sheree Jacobus put the suit together, and it was based on work that had been done in James Watt's Mountain Region legal fund. And the suit was that the federal government had violated the statehood compact by failing to ask the people of Alaska, as the compact theory would have it, before they passed the Claims Settlement Act, if the people of Alaska were okay with giving 44 million acres of land to Alaska Natives, and again failing to ask the people of Alaska when the Alaska Lands Act passed in 1980, if it was okay with the people of Alaska if the federal government created 104 million acres of new federal conservation units in Alaska. And the suit argued that the revenue that would have been collected from those lands, a piece of the Statehood Act that people may not recall, is that the way that Congress figured that Alaska statehood and Alaska state administration would be paid for was that 90% of all federal mineral lease revenue collected in Alaska, that's mineral lease revenue, oil lease, mining leases that were on federal land in Alaska that you had to pay to get the lease, 90% of that money would be given to the state of Alaska, and that would be where the money would come from to support statehood. Well, the Hickel suit in 1991-1992 charged that the value of the resource revenue, federal mineral resource revenue, that would have been collected on the 44 million acres and would have been collected on 104 million acres if they hadn't been reserved for natives and been reserved for the federal government, would have been $29 billion. So they sued the federal government for $29 billion for violating the statehood compact. Well, the suit went nowhere. I mean, it was heard in the Federal Court of Claims, and the judge, a guy named Brugink, wrote that a statehood act is not analogous to a commercial contract. It's not the same kind of thing. It's sui generis. And he said that Congress can pass any legislation that it wants to pass, even if that legislation totally contradicts legislation it's passed previously, unless Congress said in the legislation that it intended to be bound in perpetuity by what it was doing. Well, Congress, the Supreme Court has said to the Congress, you want to be careful about saying that because then you are bound. And so you find that language in very, very few statutes, and you don't find it in any statehood act. The state appealed. The state appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit, I think it was the Ninth Circuit, anyways, one of the circuit courts. Well, the Ninth Circuit rendered what I think is one of the classic decisions in the history of adjudication in the United States, constitutional adjudication. It was a one-liner. It said, the lower court has said everything that can be said on this issue, period. That's it. That's the whole finding. The state appealed then to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court didn't take the case. They denied the writ. So we don't really have finality on that issue yet. On the other hand, the whole history of the way the Supreme Court has dealt with statehood compacts, and Alaska is not the first state to bring this argument, is not in favor of the states. The Supreme Court has taken a position of federal sovereignty, trumps state sovereignty, and unless in the specific instance the court finds for some reason that it doesn't, and they have not found so in statehood acts.
Well, Professor Steve Haycox, I have a whole list of possible areas where Alaska might be in leadership, and I will just cross off the one that says as a laboratory for federalism.
Well, what the Constitution provides is that federal sovereignty trumps state sovereignty unless the Constitution is silent on the issue. So in any one day, there are cases in the courts somewhere where a state is contesting federal sovereignty or the federal government is contesting state sovereignty. That's the way we find out what the Constitution really means and where it is. And so far, the preponderance of judicial opinion is that on the matter of a statehood act, an enabling act or a statehood act, federal sovereignty has the upper hand.
Well, so here we are. The Statehood Act is passed and it has its terms, and some are, like Wally Hickel, are thinking that it's a contract, and it turns out the courts say it's not. But nonetheless, this is the deal the state's voters decided to accept, and it was a deal that allowed the federal government a good deal more control, I think, than people realize now. We still had the potential military reservation of the entire northern part of the state, should the president choose to exercise that. And we still had no control over fish and game. The state didn't get that till later. And we had kind of the inkling that there was going to be a huge amount of the land in the state would belong to the federal government no matter what.
All that is very, very true. The Statehood Act was not particularly favorable to state sovereignty. A young attorney has written a wonderful article, Mike Schwager, which was in the Alaska Law Review, on this, talking about originality in the Alaska Constitution. He argues that the founders, the writers of the Alaska Constitution, had Congress looking over their shoulder, in a sense, and they were very careful not to put into the Constitution anything that might offend the federal government, anything that might offend Congress, and give them a reason for rejecting statehood. And when the Constitution was written, 55, 56, there was no guarantee that Congress was going to vote for Alaska statehood. In fact, everything looked like they were not going to vote for it. So in the Statehood Act, I think you have a lot of the same thing. You remember that it wasn't until Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, effectively changed his mind, and he had opposed statehood, and then in coming into the summer of 1958, he suddenly changed his mind, and he got Lyndon Johnson to change his mind, and with that, statehood was I wouldn't say it was assured, but it was certainly much more positive. But even to get statehood through, Rayburn had to go to an arcane rule in the House. He had to make the House a committee of the whole because the Rules Committee chair would not allow the Alaska bill to come out because he was steadfastly opposed to Alaska statehood. But by making the House a committee of the whole, that superseded any committee chair, any committee action, and they could bring the bill out onto the floor, which is exactly what Rayburn did, and that's how it passed. So understanding how problematical it was, how formidable it was to try to get that bill through, whatever Congress wanted to put in that bill that may have been disadvantageous to the state, Bartlett had to go along with. And Bartlett was the key guy in this, much more than Greening, had to go along with and did. And so the bill came out not particularly favorable to Alaska. One of the things that Alaska's congressional delegation has had to do through the years, and which I think whatever else one may say about them, our delegation has done extraordinarily well. Let's educate the Congress about what Alaska's all about. Alaska's out of state, out of mind for most people, certainly most people in Washington, D.C., and not because of any nefarious designs. It's just they got other things to do, and their vision is not toward this upper remote northwest corner of the country. So it's to educate people. And our delegation has done a terrific job of saying, look, we don't need this PKK line, Porcupine, Koyukuk, Kuskokwim line, north of which the federal government retained the right, if you will, to reserve the land and not allow it to go into state title and so forth. We don't need to retain control over fish and game, although that came up again in 98 and 99, as you know, as a function of ANILCA. But it's been a tough sled because you have to explain to people what the situation is.
I'm glad you basically gave me the perfect segue to the real question, I think, of today's program, which is where can Alaska lead? Where does Alaska lead? Where could it lead? Give it the next 50 years. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is energy. It would appear that we're kind of over a barrel and yet with great opportunity in the area of energy because our state treasury is swelled. People are in desperate need for energy solutions. They can't put up windmills fast enough. They can't weatherize houses fast enough. People have got religion about energy in Alaska, and perhaps this could lead to a leadership position. What do you think?
Well, it might, and I think it's a neat topic to talk about because I don't think that when the drafters of Alaska statehood were thinking about it, that they were thinking of, well, we want to create a state that leads. What they were interested in was we want to get statehood, and we want the independence and the freedom of control that represents to whatever degree that might be. But The Alaska mantra, of course, has always been exceptionality. We're unique. There's nobody like Alaskans. There's no place like Alaska. You ask any Alaskan on the street if Alaska's different, and of course they're going to say yes. And you ask them, well, how? Well, then that becomes a little more problematical. But then something comes out in the nature of rugged individualism and jealousy of freedom and that sort of thing, all of which is probably true.
Rugged individualism consisting of knowing where the army surplus was being dumped.
That's right. But there was this notion that we're creating a new society in Alaska. I mean, a great deal of the rhetoric of statehood was, well, we're going to create a new society. We don't have to do it the way they do it outside. We can do it differently. As you've read, I've written that what in fact has happened much more preponderantly is replication. In fact, I have called the population of Alaska all along the coast from Ketchikan up to Haines and then skipping over to the rail belt and from Seward and Valdez up to Anchorage and then on up to the Valley and Fairbanks, and where most of the population of Alaska is concentrated. You probably have 2/3 of the population of Alaska concentrated. I've called that the replication corridor, because what happens in the replication corridor is seeking to replicate the material norms of American culture. And if people can't do that, if they can't have a job that will allow them to have the SUV and allow them to have all the fishing poles that they want and allow them to have the 2,500-foot square foot house and the like, they're not going to be here. And we know that from when oil prices crashed in 1985, 1986, fell from $40 a barrel to $15, and then still later, $9 a barrel. And revenue from oil production in Alaska fell from $4.1 billion in 1981 to $1.8 billion in 1986. Jobs evaporated like water in the desert. State institutions were told to submit three budgets, a maintenance budget, a 10% reduced budget, and a 20% reduced budget. There was a 60,000-person out-migration from Alaska in 1985, 1986. Why did those people go? They went because they didn't have jobs. In other words, they weren't here to live out on the land and get their souls together. They were here because they could have the same kind of lifestyle that people have in the rest of the United States, plus some damn good fishing. And
hopefully flush toilets.
And absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, as you well know, people who don't live in Anchorage and anywhere in that replication corridor kind of look askance at the people who do and say, well, that's not the real Alaskan and those are not real Alaskans. So what happened to this notion that was really, really quite prevalent in the statehood campaign, which is we're going to build a new society. You know, we're going to be different. We're going to do it the right way. It kind of got lost. It kind of got lost in the grasping for jobs and the necessity to do anything that you could if you really wanted to stay here, like raid the surplus pile in Mountain View. And then I think it got lost in big oil after 1974 with pipeline construction and 1977 when the state suddenly became flush with money, and people have gotten used to that. And we've all talked to lots of folks who have said, well, the real Alaska is gone now. It went away when all this money came.
Professor Steve Haycox, I clearly have pressed your button with the theme of this show. I can recall a lecture you gave that I attended where you went on in this theme and ended up singing up, "Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?"
I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful irony. I love what Janis Joplin did with that song because it kind of became the theme song of Alaska. And it's only now that people in the replication corridor faced with natural gas prices that are knocking their socks off, it's not just in rural Alaska now that we're seeing such an awful energy cost, but people are having to face it now, even here in the heart of River City, that people are beginning to wonder, well, what is Alaska all about, and am I really going to be able to stay here?
But I get the feeling that you have some hope that through all the asphalt of the replication corridor, there are some shoots, some little green shoots that are popping up. You know, crabgrass will go right through that asphalt and come popping up, and that there is the core or the impulse of an innovation there someplace.
I think it's a terrific metaphor, and I really like it. And people have sometimes, I think, misunderstood what I've been trying to say. And all I've been trying to say in Alaska, an American colony, is that we need to face reality. And if we do, we have a much, much better chance of allowing that flexibility, that spirit of innovation, that determination to live with the circumstances that we have and make something out of them. To flourish. I mean, you gotta fly 3 hours on an airplane to get to the rest of the United States from here. There's another country in between. Just perforce, even if you're living in the replication corridor, you are different. Just those two facts alone make you different. And wherever people are, for the most part, I think, they want to try to build a life. And building that life in Alaska has meant in the past, and I think it's going to mean increasingly in the future, being open to alternative energy sources, being open to those windmills, being open to geothermal, being open maybe to the idea of investing heavily in the gas line. I gave a talk 8 or 10 years ago at Downtown Rotary in which I said, if you really want to be a independent Alaskan, the way we all think that we are, then we ought to build our own pipeline instead of depending on the oil industry to build it for us. Well, we've come a long way toward that in that 8 or 10 year period for circumstances that perhaps we hadn't foreseen quite as clearly 8 or 10 years ago as we see now. So I think that we do have the potential and a little bit of a record of innovation, and I look forward to a lot more.
I think sometimes we don't realize how innovative we are. Sometimes I know we have friends from Lower 48 come up here and they can observe a lot of spunk and spirit and being in touch with the natural world in ways that that they can't even imagine. They see it right away.
And I think that dynamism, which people recognize instantly almost when they get off the airplane, really does still characterize Alaska. I would not argue that the old Alaska is dead and the old frontier spirit, if you will, is gone. And you know, it's like the way the theology of the Christian church was formed. It was clarified every time there was a heresy. Well, every time there's a hardship, I think that's when we get down to defining who we are.
Let's go to Stephen, joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stephen. I know you called quite a while ago, but I couldn't shut him up.
Oh, I think it's great. The gentleman is very interesting to listen to and set up the premise for the show well. I'm Steve Toffin from Groundswell Fisheries Movement out here in Kodiak. And I thought I was calling in on the interesting hindsight supposition about would we have been better off not to go as a state. But I like where you ended up on the question of can Alaska lead the next 50 years. And to me, the two dovetail together. In fisheries, I'm the whistleblower on the missing $2 billion every year that foreign corporations doing business in Alaska take out through hollow corporations. And the United States has done a particularly poor job of protecting itself. And as a state, concerning our own sovereignty, one answer to what we might do over the next 50 years would be to avoid replication and set a new standard in resource accountability and transparency within a democracy. I mean, without trying to become a Chavez or what happened in Russia where they had to fight back for the value of their resources. You know, we've got the Palin ideal. She said it's about time we start learning to live off the value of our own resources. And we've discovered already in oil the tremendous shortfalls that were there by bad policy. I've been a large spokesperson for it in fisheries. We watched.
But Stephen, you know, it's easier said than done. I mean, what happened? Oh, yeah. Well, you got when the Magnuson Act was passed, the fisheries went to joint ventures. But the fact of the matter is that the Norwegians and Japanese were still there. They just changed their faces, and we didn't really get anywhere until we got CDQs. And some shore-based quotas, which turned out maybe not to be such a great idea after all. And so far, it seems like, in other words, I'm saying the management of fisheries is a very imperfect art, and it's not practiced perfectly, anywhere near perfectly in Alaska.
No, it isn't. But where we're short on good decision-making is a lack of real information. We don't have accountability and transparency. We don't know what goes on inside these global corporations. You know, the General Accounting Office used to be called that. I think it's called the Government Accountability Office now. Again, came out with a recent report that got a lot of press nationwide about 30-some thousand foreign corporations doing $2.5 trillion in sales in the United States paying zero income taxes.
Yeah.
And by shifting through the products, the profits across borders.
Yeah, we had a guest on here called it Pump and Dump. Stephen, stay with us, and we'll bring Professor Haycox into the conversation here as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsized into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's Talk of Alaska. It's primary election day, and 50 years ago today, Alaskans were voting yes to become a part of the lower 48. Yeah, it was 48. We booted number 49. Hawaii was number 50. That's how it worked. And Stephen is with us from Kodiak, and I'd like to give Professor Steve Haycox, our panelist here, a chance to chime in on this fisheries issue.
I really appreciate your comments, Stephen. And not in any way to diminish the challenges that exist in the fishery now, and I think you've identified the most significant one. But over the last 50 years, how would you assess Alaska's fish policy? It seems to me that compared to what's happened in British Columbia and especially California and now Washington and Oregon, Alaska has a fairly good track record of managing the fishery in a sustainable manner and generating profitability out of it for to some degree, certainly for Alaskans, so much so that I think that people down there kind of look with envy to the Alaska fishery. Now, and once again, let me say that this in no way would I want that comment to diminish the significance of the challenges that you've identified. But what do you think of the last 50 years of Alaska fish policy?
To the degree that we were on best science, we were on the route. What happened is when the Fisheries Act was passed, it was called Tier 1 legislation to deal with biological and conservation management issues. And it was always known that the Congress would have to come back and do Tier 2 legislation involving economics. But starting in the early 1990s, maybe late 80s, an attempt was made, especially in the late 80s, to do overcapacity investment by foreign nations onshore in Alaska when there was already enough capacity to harvest the product. And we let our fish council be taken over by those who had an interest in assigning the economic rights to large industry players and concentrating them. You probably are aware of what a resource curse is.
Indeed.
Yeah, and so we headed down that path where instead of spreading the wealth around, we let a few cronies and their politicians start to take it away in high rants. And I'm sort of the living testimonial to the fact that billions of dollars a year did go missing. You don't see money missed, just like you don't see fish missed. And we're starting to now figure out that maybe the pollock stocks aren't so healthy. It's been pretty big news this last week that new measures are coming into place to handle it. But you mentioned doing it the right way and staying on the larger scope of issues of resources. in order to do it the right way, we sort of have to position Alaska in terms of what is bad United States policy affecting Alaska today. And I can offer three key insights. Number one, economists are well aware that the Washington consensus of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank has failed the United States in dealing with foreign nations and resource providers. I think it's done so. A version of that has been happening to Alaska. Number two, there's a national policy on China today where we basically ignore its mercantilist system and what's really going on and the threat that it could become. When you talk about an all-state or an in-state gas line and using our own resources, I'm very much in favor of that. And number three, we've allowed Ted Stevens to basically become a committee of one through riders, and he has sunk our state constitutional protections. Now we're finding out about the oil value, with the role of Cheney, Vico, and other players. We went through these.
Hello, Stephen. Looks like we lost him, but that's...
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, and I think open debate has been one of our fortes in Alaska, and maybe we're seeing, for example, now the issue come up of who are we competing with on the world oil market? We're competing with a lot of governments who control the resource.
Absolutely. Exxon is tiny compared to
absolutely.
You know, nationalized oil
absolutely.
Companies.
Absolutely. And you know, this is kind of the curse of freedom in America is that our commitment to free enterprise essentially prevents the nationalization of industries, and yet we're competing against nationalized resources, not just in oil, but in other, as the gentleman suggests, and perhaps in fish as well. So I think the more debate, the more information we can get out about that, Elmer Rasmussen said when the Permanent Fund was created that the only way that it was going to work would be if the Board of Trustees and the state administration educated the Alaskan people as to what it was about. And that was his fundamental principle in managing the Permanent Fund, aside from conservative investment, was we've got to explain to the Alaskan people what this is. And once they understand it, they'll support it. And I think he was absolutely right about that.
Oh, so it sure is hard to explain to anybody that doesn't live here and get that check. I'll tell you that.
Indeed.
Let's go to Eagle River and Jim. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah, the category that suggests itself as to what Alaska may still lead in seems to me possibly corruption.
Whoa, I knew that was going to come up.
I thought you were asking for it, but no one had mentioned it. I thought I should. Both the overt corruption, the prevalence, and the acceptance by Alaskans of, a lot of people say, well, why vote someone else in? They're all corrupt.
Well, yeah, Jim, you know, that is really interesting because, the FBI it actually gets applause now. And it's almost as if we needed the FBI to save us from ourselves, that we couldn't have done it ourselves.
We still might, because how many local prosecutions have there been of corruption? And I don't know how other states are, except my memories of Oregon 35 years ago. But, Illinois is famous, or Chicago.
The graveyard vote. Yeah, and then
the city is for sale. You know, they do anything anyone with money says. Well, that's pretty much our system.
I think we have some significant problems in Alaska. I don't know that we really stick out in terms of corruption at the state level. Much of what one reads about the history of state administration argues that there's a good deal more corruption at the state level and at the local level than there is at the federal level. I guess where we did lead is we are the first state to have their senator's house torn up by the FBI. All that, of course, is a function of the creation of the public integrity section of the Justice Department after Watergate. But Louisiana, of course, maybe takes the leadership role in corruption.
Yeah, I was hoping to hear that from an historian.
New Jersey is not that great. New York, before his demise, Eliot Spitzer was the first governor in many, many years to make some progress at trying to clean up the corruption in the state administration of New York. But I think we have a colonial problem here. Of course, whether Alaska is a colony anymore depends on how you're going to define colony. And of course, I to me, to, to me,
Jim, are you still there? That looks like we lost Jim. He made his point.
He made his point, and it's a good one. But it seems to me that up here is a colony, or essentially, I think, a colony because of dependence. There aren't very many people to talk to. I mean, just the population of Alaska is still pretty darn small at 680 or 690,000 people. And the leadership cadre isn't that big. And the people with real money, if you will, are fairly few in number. And it takes money to get things done. It takes politics. It takes some level of power to get things done, to try to do good for the collective, for all of the people of Alaska. And there just aren't that many people in that circle. And I think that has led to a couple of problems. One is that it has isolated and insulated the people in that circle a little bit. And, of course, it's led to a little bit of hubris. They sort of get used to the notion that they are the folks who make things happen in Alaska. And so I think that the FBI has indeed done us a huge favor. It's questionable whether the state administration could have operated at the level that the federal government has in this regard. And maybe we'll get a fresh start here.
You know, it's almost a continuum. When you look back at Alaska's history and you run across people like Ernest Greening, Frank Heitzelman, these people had – it was an old school paternalistic mentality entirely. We know what's good for Alaska.
I think it's easy to fall into that when you are the kingpin, if you will, or among the group of kingpins in a real small population. You have some success. You find out how things work, and you're able to bring that knowledge and whatever power it represents to bear to make a few things happen. And it's got to be pretty heady and a great sense of achievement when you can make things happen. I mean, when you make things like the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act happen, or at the state level, you make things like limited entry fishery happen, or that's got to feel like, gee whiz, we really were able to accomplish something. And that's going to lead, I think, to a sense of, well, I know how to do it and other folks don't.
Well, over and over again, we've seen people run for the legislature and they're advocating term limits while they're running until their turn comes. And they say, well, I just figured out how to do this. People don't understand. You know, now I can really be effective. This is the wrong time to get rid of me.
Americans have been arguing about term limits for a long time, and they always fall on exactly that point. Oh, everybody but me.
Let's go to Don, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Hey, hi, Steve. Hi. And Steve, this is Don Mitchell, and I was just sitting around at my computer listening to you guys, and I had two quick comments about Steve's analysis. One was that, with all due respect, this business
always watch out when an attorney says "with all due respect."
Right, because that's what's coming. But there's no evidence that I've ever been able to see in the historical record that anyone in Alaska wanted to do anything except replicate the middle-class material culture of the lower 48. And in fact, the argument was that the federal government was thwarting that objective by treating Alaska as a colony and preventing the local exploitation of natural resources that would generate money and able to, in order to accomplish that very objective. And if you look at what's gone on in the bush since the three of us have been up here, there has been a political consensus that everyone is entitled, wherever they live in Alaska, to exactly the same material culture as Seattle or Tacoma. And in fact, that's why Tony Knowles, responding to that, vowed, as you guys know, to banish the honey bucket from rural Alaska. So that's the first point. Second point is that, looking back on it, statehood made absolutely no economic sense. It fell into looking like sense because of what happened after the decision was made to allow Alaska into the Union, but as George Rogers and others have documented, there was no way for this place to support on its own the level of federal subsidy. And Bill Egan was was running the operating budget off of Cook Inlet bonus lease money, and but for the 64 earthquake, which put billions of dollars up here like Exxon Valdez, and then that held us on until Prudhoe Bay, but Prudhoe Bay was not on the table when the decision in Congress was made to allow Alaska to enter the Union. So anyway, as I was sitting here, it seemed to me that the analysis that you guys were discussing was not necessarily supported by the historical record, and I thought it'd be useful to throw that on the table. And then the last thing I'd say is the idea that anyone would give 300,000 people or less two seats in the United States Senate is a truly astounding policy decision that was made in 1958, and I think that subject is entitled to more thinking about. So that's it.
All right, Don. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Don. I'm not sure that there's any difference between what I've said in Alaskan American Colony and your first two points. My point would be, though, that the rhetoric of exceptionality, which I think has been consistent throughout Alaska history, I don't think if you look, at least I haven't found, people saying, well, Alaska is just like anywhere else. The fact of the matter is that Alaska has been just like anywhere else. But the way that people talk about Alaska, particularly anybody in Alaska, is that Alaska is exceptional, that it's unique, that it's different, and we are creating a new society, and we don't give a damn how they do it outside. That's what got me interested in Alaska in the first place, and it's still what gets my intellectual juices going, is the disconnect between the last frontier rhetoric, which is all about rugged individualism and doing it our way on the one hand, and the reality of Alaskan lives, particularly in that replication corridor. I think you can make some argument that things are a little bit different in Honeybucket land. But as you point out, everybody is moving as quickly as they can away from that. But that disconnect between the rhetoric, the exceptionality rhetoric, which is just deeply embedded on the one hand, and the reality of Alaska economic life particularly, and I think economics does explain Alaska better than perhaps any other category. It's just exciting for me. I find it really wonderful. How do we explain that? How do we explain this commitment to the rhetoric of exceptionality? I've given any number of papers at conferences on exactly this subject and pointing out this disconnect. One commentator on a paper I gave a few years ago at the Western History Association meeting said, she had in fact met some Alaska replicants, and I seemed to be right. And it was clear that if the West was just like America, only more so, that Alaska was just like the American West, only more so. And I think both comments are proper.
Now that's a real zinger and a good place to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about Alaska statehood. We'll probably keep coming back to this, too, as we go through this 50th anniversary exercise. Probably should have started it about a year ago, but better late than never, because maybe by understanding where we came from, we can get a better idea of where we're going. And Professor Steve Haycox is with us. He's the author of Alaska, an American Colony. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. And we've been kind of discussing not just the history of statehood, but the hopes of the people at the time and whether we lived up to any of those. And if we didn't, why not? And what could we lead in in the next 50 years? Alaska seems to be somewhat of a frontier of the imagination, perhaps. Let's go to Chris, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris.
Hi there. Hey, Steve. Hey, Cox. Chris Constant calling. You know, I have a question for you. Last week, you wrote a column about the founding of democracy. You know, and I studied the humanities. I'm by no means an expert. I seem to recall a cautionary tale of the Delian League in ancient Greece. So this is a really juicy question for a history professor. And the fall of the first real democracy in Greece caused by people realizing they could vote themselves the contents of the treasury. Do you see any parallels?
That's a great question.
You know, I was at a community radio station one time where the board of directors was dominated by people who were on the air. You could always have the hopes of getting a majority for what you wanted to have on the radio. It was continuous revolution. It was terrible.
Pocketbook always presents a problem. I mean, one of the things the Greeks said was that comfort was a legitimate quest for human beings. But where is the line between personal comfort and the comfort of the society? The Delian League indeed fell apart both on problems of voting money to the people and also imperial design. One little point of clarification, the Lycians, whom I wrote about last Friday, had the first representative democracy, not the first democracy, but the first representative democracy. They had representatives coming from the various cities and representing their interests. But it's a great question. I mean, we have the permanent fund question in Alaska. Can we ever divert money from the earnings of the permanent fund to any other object than the dividend distribution and every politician in Alaska. I know even in this election where it really doesn't need to be an issue because of the current surplus, I noticed that some of the candidates were saying they want to protect the permanent fund, meaning they don't want your check to be jeopardized by any potential redirection of the earnings. So that political Gerald Macbeth up in Fairbanks.
You know, you give it 50 years and this could be our demise.
Well, it could be. Let me talk just briefly about Jerry Macbeth up in political science department in Fairbanks, who's one of the few people in Alaska to have the courage, if that's what it is, to say, the permanent fund is the worst thing that ever happened to Alaska, or at least the permanent fund dividend distribution is the worst thing that ever happened to Alaska, is because it prevents that fund from being used for anything else. It encourages the entitlement, the government is here to give me money mentality. And I really give Macbeth credit for that because I think that he's really got his finger on an essential piece of modern Alaska.
Chris?
Well, yeah, and for what it's worth, I would suggest that what we do at this point is just quit the investment in the permanent fund, create a new one for government services, and let that $40 billion stand on its own. But I'll let it go because I see a strong parallel, and it's a cautionary tale. That's
yeah.
it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we'll revisit that on this program because the it's a live issue of what sort of fiscal plan should Alaska have. I mean, is it really right that we invest this in tobacco companies and Exxon and so forth? Couldn't it be invested in something that would really be an investment? That was Tom Fink's point. But when Tom was talking about it, he meant the Susitna Dam.
That's
People
right.
didn't go along with that. Let's go to Haynes and Eric. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eric.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I thought maybe I'd put a little bit of lightness in there. It's getting pretty heavy. Professor, do you remember when you were speaking about the salvage lot in Mountain View? I remember when I first came to Alaska, and I believe it was like between 1954 and 1956, there was one of the greatest department stores in the world right across the street from that lot, and it was called Caribou Pete's,
mm-hmm.
which later I think someone told me became Caribou Ward's.
May have. And of course, the big emporium in Alaska around statehood was Piggly Wiggly.
Yeah, Piggly Wiggly was the grocery store. It was Caribou Pete's was right across the street from, they actually had a name for it. I think it was like a surplus, but it was that big surplus dump that Fort Rich and Elmendorf had, and it was on the old road that went out to through Bowden View that went out to
Dravis Drive, yeah,
the main gate.
Yeah. Well, and unless I'm mistaken, and maybe they want to call in, but I think the B&J store on Northern Lights also started as a surplus store, and so did Fifth Avenue Outfitters downtown, I think. Both of those started as surplus stores. In fact, when I got here in 1970, I'm kind of a newcomer, but when I came in 1970, I actually furnished part of my house by going out to the R&M sales on Elmendorf Air Force Base, which they held once a week. And you could go out and get some nice oak furniture if you didn't have any other means. And at that time, as a fresh graduate student, I didn't.
Well, Caribou Pete's was interesting because when you walked into the door over by the cash register on the right-hand side, he had three bazookas and a couple of cases of mortar shells. And he said, don't worry about them. They're all dummies, just like the guy that runs the store.
Very nice.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
And have a nice day.
You betcha.
All right. Running out of time, as I thought we'd get through a whole list of possible areas where Alaska could be a leader in the future, and we barely touched on any of them, and the one we went the most depth on is corruption and maybe energy. Let's go to Bethel and Pam. Pamela, I noticed we got an email from you. Oops, she's gone. Well, I'll just read your email then. Seems to me that as long as many Alaskans think of Alaska as a set of resources to exploit on the market for Alaska alone, there will always be a colony mentality and a colony mediocrity.
Yeah, that's a deep comment. The mediocrity is maybe the more interesting piece of that. Does in fact dependence lead to a failure to innovate and a lack of courage? I think that's a debate that Alaskans should engage in and might be very fruitful.
Well, you're a professor of history. You write the history. People have to make the history before you can write it. And you know, I think we're in the process of making it. And that's certainly my perception, just as hosting this program for, like, you know, as many years as it's been going on, that we tend to stand real close to history quite frequently in Alaska.
Oh, I think we do, and it's because we're so new, and it's because the population is small yet, and so the actions of any single individual feel bigger, perhaps, than they would elsewhere. I appreciated your comment earlier, too, that we are making history, and we don't always recognize it. I think that's very clear in Alaska.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor Steve Haycox.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Look forward to having you back again, and Alaskans seem to have plenty to say on the subject of Alaska as a leader and what the vision might be for Alaska in the future. Gooseberry Peter on the controls, Emily Butler on the phones, Duncan Moon's our managing editor. I'm Steve Heimel. Don't forget to vote.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.